Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I am your host, Hala Gores, and here with me in the studio is attorney Tom Nelson. Good morning, Tom, and thank you for joining me on One Land, Many Voices.
It's a pleasure to be here, Hala. Thank you very much.
Our regular co-host, Will Seaman, is unable to be here this morning. Will is recording a lecture by Paul Roberts, author of The End of Oil, and more recently, The End of Food. I look forward to Will's return to our next regularly scheduled program of One Land, Many Voices, as you know, every fourth Friday of the month. Before we get started, I want to give credit to our wonderful music by Iraqi oudist Rahim Al-Hajj, opening with Dance of the Palms. It's from his album, Iraqi Music in a Time of War. We welcome your participation in this morning's program. If you have questions for our guests, please call us in the studio at 503-231-8187. I'll repeat that. That's 503-231-8187. Please try to keep your questions or comments on our topic this program. Our first guest this morning is Bill Corcoran, President of American Near East Refugee Aid. Mr. Corcoran is joining us by telephone from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Mr. Corcoran. I'm not sure that we have him on yet. If you can let us know, our sound engineer, if we have Bill Corcoran on the line yet. Okay. Good morning, Mr. Corcoran.
Good morning, Hala. Good to hear you.
You too. Mr. Corcoran is President of American Near East Refugee Aid, ANIRA, and just returned from a visit to Gaza. ANIRA was incorporated in 1968 to help ease the suffering of Palestinian refugees after the war of 1967. It has become one of the largest American nonprofits working solely in the Middle East for 40 years. In fiscal year 2008, ANIRA delivered more than $50 million worth of donated medicine and medical supplies into Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Mr. Corcoran, before we delve into your most recent visit to Gaza, can you tell us about ANIRA's work in Gaza specifically?
Yes, Ella. Each month we're delivering, for instance, for medical supplies, $1 million worth of medicine to partnering hospitals and clinics there. In addition, we're running a feeding program for 25,000 children per day. This is in preschools throughout Gaza, about 200 different preschools. And the reason is primarily to combat the stifling anemia in the children that has been going on for years and is much more rampant now. In addition to those, I would say, sort of relief programs, we've got a series of development projects that had been involved in a number of things like supplying fresh water and sanitation services, working with the universities in job creation, especially in IT areas, and also working with women on loan programs. So it's been across the scale of different projects.
How has ANIRA dealt with providing humanitarian aid since the blockade began in 2006?
That's been difficult, Hala. We have been continuing to get in medicine every single month, as I said, $1 million each month. That has been permitted, and we have been able to continue the feeding programs, but slowly but surely the restrictions have increased on us, and so the range of supplies that we could bring in has lessened. I'll give you an example. For instance, during this period, we were not permitted to bring in the amalgam that dentists use for filling teeth. That was not an acceptable item on the list by the Israelis. So there's a number of things that we've been struggling with over this period of time, but the biggest struggle has been the fact that there have been no building supplies that have been available on the market, so that simple cement and steel and piping has not been permitted. So a number of our projects to build the infrastructure of Gaza have come to a halt.
What is the general situation of people in Gaza? Let's limit this to prior to the most recent assault.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm getting at is to try to give our listeners an idea of what the humanitarian situation was prior to the assault and, for instance, per capita income per Gaza, et cetera.
Sure, that's a key point. That before the war it was disastrous, and now it's even more so. And to give them an idea, the per capita income of Israel is $27,000 per year. The same statistic for Gaza is $1,000 per year, so 25 versus 1. The scene has been quite pernicious with malnutrition in children, and the water and sanitation system beforehand was literally breaking apart from the inability to import supplies or spare parts. Irrigation systems have fallen apart now, really just for the lack of pumps or valves or other things that would keep a normal irrigation system going, so that slowly but surely, even before November and December, the Gazans have ground into a subsistence level of survival.
Why don't you tell us about your observations from your most recent visit?
It was breathtaking, Hala. Years ago, I had worked in the tsunami countries, and it reminded me of my first visit to Banda Aceh, Indonesia, after the tsunami hit. In some of the areas of northern Gaza Strip, near Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia, you could literally look for miles and not see a home because they had all been demolished. And these are homes that would be, by American standards, middle class, beautiful cement homes that were 2 and 3 stories high. Used to involve a large family, and they were gone. And all you could see was an occasional tent that was pitched on the remains of the house, and it was the family sort of trying to reclaim their property. I saw that in residences. You also see it in the industrial sector, and it's so extensive that I would call it de-development, to the point that, for instance, the 8 cement factories that dotted Gaza Strip have all been destroyed, and even to the point where the cement trucks were tipped over by tanks and then run over by the tanks to totally destroy them from any possibility of reuse. So it's been rather a thorough disintegration of society in Gaza Strip.
What happened to the partners that Anera worked with in Gaza?
Some of them have not survived. And, for instance, we had worked with the American International School, which probably your viewers have seen pictures of it on TV. That was rather symbolic of the destruction that's hard to grasp. Another one was Al-Quds Hospital, which is run by the Palestinian Red Crescent. It was a hospital that, with U.S. taxpayer monies, we had just renovated last November, and now it's 80% destroyed. So that was rather breathtaking, because I knew the work beforehand, and then I just saw it recently, and it's really tragic.
In light of this devastation that you have described, devastation of blocks and blocks of homes, are you looking at housing repairs, or what are you looking at?
Well, at the present time, what people have done to cope is they moved, some of them moved into their extended families' homes, and so you've got twice as many people in small spaces. The other reaction was that some people have moved into tent communities, which are now dotting the Gaza Strip. That's the only way that people are coping right now, because we can't get building supplies into Gaza. Neither cement nor steel are still permitted there. Nothing's coming in besides food and medicine. So we would like to do home repairs, and we would like to do actual reconstruction, but that's going to have to be in the future once something is arranged for a more liberal permit or access process on the borders.
I want to ask our listeners to be patient with us. I see calls coming in, and there's a great deal to ask of Mr. Corcoran. Why don't we, in fact, go ahead and take our first caller this morning, if we can. Go ahead, caller.
Lebanon.
Go ahead, caller. I'm sorry. Can you start from the beginning, caller?
Yes. Good morning, Hala.
Good morning.
My name is Kamal Hassan, and I'm a Palestinian refugee. I was born in Lebanon because of the Israeli aggression. I respect greatly what Mr. Corcoran and Mr. Nielsen are doing for the Palestinians, but I fail to understand, where did we go wrong in American media? You know, we've always been the victim. Our land was taken by Israel, And in the American media, we're portrayed as the villains. Where did we go wrong? I would like to understand that. Thank you.
Sure. Bill, is that something that's within your purview, or should I have Tom Nelson take on that question?
Probably it might be more appropriate for Tom to handle.
Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Well, it's we see a long history of negative caricatures of Palestinians in particular and Arabs in general. And I think it's largely because of the problems that have arisen between in the Middle East because of Israel. Israel realizes that it is an upstart state and that it has upset a lot of Arabs and Palestinians by its presence and more importantly by its actions, its ongoing actions. And so, frankly, the Israeli interests are much better represented in the United States than are the Palestinian and Arab. The result is that, frankly, the media that you see over here in the United States is very strongly biased in favor of Israel and very strongly biased against Arabs and Palestinians. You can't get a fair national coverage of issues, just a balanced coverage on the national media. CNN International, for example, gives a reasonably balanced approach. Not very good, but it's reasonably balanced, whereas the CNN you see in America is CNN America. And you don't get the pictures of what is really happening in the Middle East. The same applies. You can't get Al Jazeera in the United States, even on your satellite dish. And I have a satellite, and I've written to them about it. Even though Al Jazeera English is produced in Washington, D.C. So it is really a stranglehold on the national media that's causing a lot of the problems. And it's only recently have we seen some cracks in that wall. For example, there was a 60 Minutes piece about two, 3 months ago that gave a reasonably balanced presentation regarding how settlers' attitudes in Israel toward the, or actually in Palestine toward the Palestinians. It's a slow process, but the caller is absolutely right that there is a enormous blame the victim mentality in the American media.
Let me get back to Mr. Corcoran. You talked about nothing getting in but food and medicine. Can you talk to us about how much food is needed and how much food is in fact getting in?
Mm-hmm. Right now, Hala, I would say it is subsistence level. People are surviving, but we are seeing definitely through UNICEF calculations of the situation, the beginnings of malnutrition, particularly in children. The ability to import, the ability to grow vegetables and fruit is non-existent right now in most of Gaza. And as a result, all the fruit and vegetables are coming in from Israel. So most people can't afford that right now, and the children are unfortunately the most vulnerable in that pecking order. The food that is coming in is, as I said, adequate. It's coming in through the United Nations and NGOs like ANERA. We're getting that throughout all of the Gaza Strip. But to give you an idea of the number of trucks coming in each day, Hala, it's about 135 trucks per day. What we need is 500 trucks per day. So we're not even close to a thriving society. It really is just a matter of existence at this point in time.
You know, it's if one looks for it, it's easy to see the devastation, the physical effect on people, on villages. You have to search for it because it's not in the mainstream media. But can you talk about the invisible effects on the people of Gaza?
Yeah, the worst, again, would be the children. Everybody seems traumatized by it. I'd say that our staff, for instance, of 20 there in Gaza, they're skilled professionals, and yet when I visited, you could see that they were hesitant and unable to focus sometimes, and they were really having a difficulty in putting out the amount of work they had before the war. But that's adults. The children, in going to preschools, I noticed a number of children, they would literally shy away from me because they were frightened. And yet months ago, they would come running up to me and grab me and start talking. They're not able to do that now. And on the Tuesday of the Israeli election, there was a huge thunderstorm in Gaza. And while everyone welcomed the rain, the children hated the noise of the thunder and the lightning, because they immediately presumed that it was the F-16s coming back from Israel to bomb them. And so they were terrified all night. And the next day, our office was finding it very difficult to work because all of the parents had been up consoling their children.
Let's go ahead and take our next call. Go ahead, caller.
Hello, is that me?
Yes, it is you.
Yeah, I'm a Palestinian. I born and raised in a jail. It's a big jail surrounded with barbs, wires, guns, tanks, rockets. It's a big jail. There is 1.5 million people lived in, they call it Gaza. I don't call it Gaza City, I call it the jail that had been going on for a long time. Israeli militant control the water, the food, the medicine, the education, the jobs, the destiny of the people. I'm wondering for how long the suffering has to keep going on. The sanction of food and supplies for the people of Gaza. The criminals, the Israeli leaders are war criminals. For how long they're going to be free? And one election with the price of Palestinian blood.
Thank you, caller. I think that part of what Tom Nelson's going to do is address this issue of what can be done in accountability. But getting back to Mr. Corcoran, let's talk about that. I mean, what is needed to alleviate the suffering right now?
The NGO community, Hala, is requesting some very, very specific things, and we just made an open letter to George Mitchell today, the new envoy, and asking him to help us in some very specific areas. One of them was that we need greater access of our staff to get into Gaza. Right now, we have over 40 staff in Jerusalem and the West Bank for ANERA, and we can't get them into Gaza. They're trained professionals, and yet they're not allowed to supplement the staff that we have there in Gaza. That would be one thing that would help us out immensely. Second thing is loosening the restrictions on the border for the entry of supplies. The biggest thing is we need cement, we need building supplies to begin to construct the future, and if nothing else, just repair the damaged water and sanitation systems, because the possibility of infection from open sewage is dramatic right now. And the third thing we need is of course, a political solution. And I don't know exactly how to do that, but the current situation is absolutely inhumane, and it's got to change quickly.
Yeah, I want to add a little bit to that. The situation is terrible. One of the truly ironic things is the only non-Israel access to Gaza is through Rafah, down on the southern part of Gaza in the Sinai. And the issue there is that, frankly, the Mubarak government, the Egyptian government, is working hand in glove with the Israelis. And by extension, I think we can blame Israel too much. That may sound strange coming from me, but the real problem isn't Israel. The real problem is Washington, D.C., and Congress, largely Congress, that allows these practices to occur. But for the United States, the kinds of events that we've seen in the last 2 months would not have happened. And they happened because of the active support of the United States government. And now that we have a new president, perhaps that'll change, but the larger issue is Congress is a real problem. There are very few Congress people brave enough to say anything about it. Brian Baird from our neighboring state of Washington had the courage to go over there and to address the issues about how do you open up the Gaza crossings? How do you get humanitarian relief to these people? He's going to be condemned mightily by the Israeli lobby, by AIPAC and all of the other pro-Israeli concerns that also have an enormous influence on the American Congress. So the problems that we talk about in Gaza, we can say, yes, the Israelis are doing this and the Israelis are doing that. But if America said, open up the gates, let the goods, let the humanitarian aid, let the building materials come in, it would open up. The problem is not in Israel. I don't have that many good things to say about the Israeli government, but at the end of the day, the problem isn't in Israel. It's in America.
Mr. Corcoran, what do you say about this? Is ANERA able to use the Rafah crossing from Egypt to get supplies in?
No, Hala, that's been very unreliable. There's no system there. that gives us any dependability of when shipments can come in. So we've avoided that up to this point. There's also no infrastructure there that's still standing. The Israelis damaged most of the infrastructure that would have permitted cargo to come through. So at the present time, we're going only through Kerem Shalom, and that is slow, as I was saying before.
We're talking to Bill Corcoran, president of American Near East Refugee Aid. Mr. Corcoran, how can our listeners get in contact with ANIRA?
The best thing would be through our website, which is www.anera.org, and that's A-N-E-R-A. ANERA.org would give you a full array of who we are, how we work over there, and things that people could do in very concrete and simple ways. And it would also assure your listeners that we are of a credible organization that's, matter of fact, a contractor with the U.S. government and fully trusted by them and fully audited so that they wouldn't have any fears about working with us.
Yes. Thank you so much, Bill Corcoran, for joining us this morning to let the listeners of One Land, Many Voices get a picture of the grim situation in Gaza.
Thanks so much.
Tom Nelson, thank you so much for stepping in for Will Seaman and to discuss the situation in Gaza. I'll let our listeners know that Tom just recently returned from Gaza as a member of a National Lawyers Guild delegation of eight attorneys who went to Gaza to assess the effects of the recent attacks on the Palestinian people and to determine what, if any, violations of international law occurred and whether U.S. domestic law has been violated as a consequence. Tom, before we get started with questions, why don't we take one more caller? Go ahead, caller.
Hello. I wonder if you could speak to the news that Secretary of State Clinton is ready to pledge $900 million to the rebuilding of Gaza, contingent on Hamas and Fatah working something out so that the United States is not dealing with Hamas. At the same time, Netanyahu is saying that such a reconciliation is impossible and will create more problems.
Yeah, this is Tom Nelson. the offer of $900 million is frankly not very much money compared to what Israel gets per year from the United States already.
That's true.
They get over $3 billion right out of your tax dollars that we can ill afford in these days. More importantly, they get a lot of additional funds that are kind of under the table in that they'll take a loan from the United States and then those loans are routinely forgiven.
Oh, I'm totally with you on that. Yeah. My question is, at least there is something on the table, and the question is, how can the reconciliation happen so that you can even get that money?
Well, I hope it does happen, and there are discussions between the two factions today in Cairo, as I understand it. I think the last thing that Israel wants to see is any kind of reconciliation because it likes things the way they are, with the Palestinians turned against themselves so that they don't have a united front to Israel. And at the end of the day, I don't think Israel's interested in peace. I think Israel's interested in land. And if they do have to go to negotiations over these kinds of issues, how do we give land for peace, what will be the result? The United States' attitude seems to be at the executive level, not at the congressional level, with a few exceptions, but at the executive level, seems to be a bit more humane than it was during the Bush administration. But how do you get Hamas to reconcile with Fatah? Those of you who watch that issue very closely know the reasons why there's this acrimony between the two sides and know how unpopular the Fatah leadership, Abu Mazen is, and how corrupt that man is. Nonetheless, he's our puppet, and it creates all kinds of problems. I have met Ismail Haniyeh, and I have met some of the other leaders of the Hamas leadership, and let me tell you this, they are not unpopular. They are exceedingly popular because of who they are. Ismail Haniyeh lives in a very simple small house with, I think, 16 other people in the refugee camp, in the beach refugee camp in Gaza. And because he is not corrupt, because he doesn't have his hands in the till and getting money from the Americans and other sources, he's very popular. On the other side of that is we demonize him. We demonize him for being a terrorist. We demonize him for heading up an organization that we don't like. That's frankly historically has, to a much greater degree than Fatah, has provided basic social services to the people of Gaza, and for that matter, to the people of Palestine. So back to your question, how do we get reconciliation between the two? It will be difficult. I'm not sure that Abu Mazen can speak for the Palestinian people anymore. One of the really strange things of the Israeli massacre, Israeli onslaught, is that it has hardened the attitudes not only of the Gazans against Israel and America, but it's also hardened the attitudes in the West Bank. And so whereas Abu Mazen was somewhat popular before, he's losing that popularity at an alarming rate. So you get reconciliation between the two. I'm not sure if I were Hamas, I'd want to get my hands dirty with the fellow.
You're listening to One Land, Many Voices, and you're tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. Also available as streaming audio at KBOO's website at www.kboo.org. Let's go ahead and take one more caller. Go ahead, caller.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Yeah. Hi, this is Jack Dress from Eugene. Hi, Hala and Tom. Tom, I met you at the Rachel Corey Foundation.
Good morning.
Yeah. I have a question since you're both attorneys. I've been wondering for some time about the possibility of Palestinians bringing class action suits in the international court against Israel. I mean, for one thing, the diaspora and the refugees have been completely excluded from all these so-called peace process negotiations. And then secondarily, I was wondering, I mean, why are we paying for Israel's destruction, you see? I mean, would it be possible for United States and other countries in the EU who provide reconstruction funds to sue Israel for repayment of what they caused? Again, in the international courts.
Thank you, caller. Go ahead, Tom.
Those are two very good issues, and frankly, the answers are difficult. Israel is not a member of the International Criminal Court, and so because they are not a member, they deny that the International Criminal Court has jurisdiction over them or their people. There is some move afoot in the International Criminal Court to see if that can't be opened up. Bringing some kind of lawsuit of that nature against Israel or Israeli individuals is not easy. About the best way of doing it is something called universal jurisdiction, which is a doctrine, international law doctrine, that says that if a country that is responsible or is harboring people responsible for war crimes, genocide, you name it, and anything of a major outrage, doesn't take action against the individuals responsible, then any country in the world can itself bring an action against those individuals. That has worked successfully in the past. As a matter of fact, there's a number of Israelis right now that dare not set foot in Europe, because there are warrants outstanding for them. That is probably the best approach, and that would lead to a criminal liability. When we talk in the United States, there's also a number of laws that you probably ought to know about that haven't been enforced against Israel, the most important of which is the Arms Export Control Act, which basically says that no country may use weaponry provided by the United States for a purpose that contravenes international law or harms the civilian population. Well, you see that in spades in Gaza. I talked to a UN munitions expert when I was in Gaza City, and he was very candid. He didn't want me to use his name, so I won't. But he was very candid, saying that virtually all or almost all of the weapons dropped by Israel on the Gaza population, including the white phosphorus, including the other bombs, including the airplanes, the F-16s, and the missiles, were American supplied. And matter of fact, he had quite a collection of expended material showing its American origin that he shared with the group. The America's provision of those weapons to Israel, in my opinion, is a violation of the Arms Export Control Act. But in order to trigger the AECA, the president or Congress has to issue a declaration, or Congress has to pass a joint resolution. The only time that that's happened in the past was back when Reagan was president, when he did in fact find that Israel had been violating the Arms Export Control Act and cut off their weaponry for an extended period of time, I think a matter of years. Now, of course, they get that weaponry back in spades. There are avenues. What I'm saying is it's not easy to bring legal actions. There are avenues available. Universal jurisdiction seems to be the best. Backing that up is perhaps some kind of claim in front of the International Criminal Court under the Treaty of Rome. And there's also action that the United States can do, the president can do, or Congress can do. It's not a both. It's an either or. I haven't seen anybody in Obama's staff suggesting they ought to do something about the recent Gaza attacks. Vehicles are available. The problem is political. The problem is educational. The problem is the ignorance of most Americans about what is really happening in Gaza and the West Bank. I don't think American people are bad people. They want to see people suffer like they're suffering in Gaza. And I think, as a matter of fact, some parts of the American media have gone out of their way to repress the information and news about that suffering because they don't want a sympathy to arise for the Gazans. Once people see what the United States is doing, the crimes that it is a party to in Gaza, certainly, and certainly in the West Bank even, I think the American people would be outraged. But again, the problem is the media and the education. And nothing can drive this point home better than sending somebody to be in Gaza or the West Bank for any period of time. I wish some of our senators and congressmen that take these free junkets to Israel would cross, get on the other side of the wall and see how people live there, thanks to their tax dollars. But get somebody over there. I have not known a person yet that's been to the Gaza and West Bank that has come back without a fire in their belly, without a sense of outrage and anger at our government, because it isn't Britain that's doing this, and it's not Italy, and it's not any other country in Europe or any other country in the world. It is America, America that is directly responsible for this. But for what America is doing, Israel would not do it, could not do it, would not have the political cover for doing it.
Tom, we know that the Israeli government and Israeli military is quite concerned about this principle of universal jurisdiction and are concerned about charges of war crimes, so much so that there was an order to shred all documents containing the names of any military personnel involved in the Gaza onslaught. Before we take any more callers and continue, let's have you talk about when you took this most recent visit to Gaza, how you got in and what you saw.
Well, getting in was an issue. Notwithstanding the idea that Israel's a close ally of the United States, et cetera, people like me that don't necessarily parrot the party line, the Israeli party line, we have difficulty getting into Israel proper. And even if you're in Israel, I've been in Israel and the West Bank probably 15, 20 times in the last 10 years. Once you get in, you're not allowed to cross over into Gaza. As Mr. Corcoran was saying, getting people into Israel you can do, but getting them down to Gaza is a problem. As a matter of fact, the assistant director at the UN was waiting to get into Gaza from October until late January to get into Gaza, and she was a UN official. Richard Falk, the UN rapporteur for human rights, was denied entry into Israel, and he's Jewish, by the Israelis. So how we got in was we knew we would have a problem. A fair number of us have been active in Palestinian matters before, and we thought our best shot would be getting in through Rafah. And we went in through Rafah, but we were told that if you go as a bunch of lawyers looking into issues of how the war was conducted, Mr. Mubarak will not like that. And so as a result, we got press credentials. And I got a press credential from this station, KBOO, and I wore it proudly. So when we presented ourselves to the Egyptians, we said we're going in as press people. We know that had we presented ourselves as lawyers going in for the kind of investigation we were undertaking, we would have been denied. As a matter of fact, the British delegation that didn't use our subterfuge was turned back just last week at the Rafah crossing. The Egyptians said, you're not going in, you're a bunch of lawyers, and the last thing they need in there is more lawyers. Well, I think they don't have enough, but that's the issue. So we went in as press people. It is not easy to get in because Hosni Mubarak and America don't want people looking into the legalities of what's happening in Gaza.
And it looks like we have more callers this morning, so let's go ahead and take our next caller. Go ahead, caller.
Is that me?
It is you. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nelson, I admire what you do, and I appreciate it as a Palestinian. I would like you to address more in depth and elaborate more about AIPAC and their effect on our policies and what they do in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Yeah, those of people that may not be terribly conversant with AIPAC and its effect, it's the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. It is a lobbying organization. Some would say it's an agent of a foreign government, and I clearly think it is, but apparently our State Department and Treasury Department don't agree. But in any event, AIPAC has an enormous influence in Washington, D.C., because it is so skilled politically. Cynthia McKinney, for example, was a congressperson who got on the wrong side of AIPAC, and she lost her seat as a result of it. They target individuals who are critical of Israeli policies, of American policies towards Israel, and they get rid of them. It has enormous strength, and the reason for its strength, I think, frankly, is because the American people have not been well informed about what Israel does in the Middle East or what it does in the occupied territories. It's hard to escape the strength of AIPAC. I think our hostess today, Hala Goris, can tell you about a personal situation she had when she faced or when she was supporting our new senator from Oregon, and how AIPAC and had an effect upon her personally. Maybe she wants to get into that, maybe not. But the point is that their tentacles are everywhere. And they have enormous power, they have enormous finances behind them, and they have a very strong political structure that is well-developed and very effective. They are a lobbying, to call them the lobbying arm would be kind of to diminish their importance. Professors Walton Mearsheimer wrote a book about AIPAC and the Israeli lobby, and came to the, and they have no axe to grind in this. They're not Palestinians. They're just looking at it as political scientists. They came to the conclusion that the Israeli lobby is so effective that the actions by America in support of Israel hurt America. I couldn't agree more with that. I think to support AIPAC is frankly unpatriotic, because you are sacrificing the interests of your own country for the benefit of a foreign power. And I don't like that if it's Israel or Colombia or any other country in the world, but I think that does not understate the power of AIPAC. It can control the United States' own interests and dramatically affect those interests in a negative manner because of its power.
I will let Tom know that I have spoken on this show about what happened with Senator Merkley. I'll just give you a brief version. I had made a donation to Senator Merkley back in November of 2007, and he took my credit card number, took the donation, the maximum $2,300, and I had a fundraiser for him at the house at which we raised $9,000. He was happy to take that money. We had conversations about how supportive he was of the Palestinian people. Months later, in February, I think it was, he met with me told me with tears in his eyes that he had to return my donation of $2,300 to me. Through investigation that we had done subsequent to that, it turns out that wasn't Mr. Merkley's decision, but it was Chuck Schumer's decision and AIPAC. So you talk about the far-reaching tentacles of AIPAC coming into Portland, Oregon, for a lawyer and an activist who has absolutely nothing to do with Washington, D.C., to get my donation returned back to me because I exercised my First Amendment right to speech by calling Israeli action in the 2006 war against Lebanon and Gaza as actions of a terrorist state. Let's get back. We have plenty of callers on the line, but I do want to get to what Tom Nelson saw on the ground in Gaza. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I think Mr. Corcoran described it well. The devastation there is enormous, and it had the infrastructure was largely destroyed. 1,300 people, more than 1,300 people dead, 40% of those civilians, many, many children dead, many, many more, about a 5-to-1 ratio injured. We visited the hospitals where we were and this was probably 3 weeks after the fact, 2 weeks after the fact, anyway, after the fact, we visited the hospitals and spoke with the victims, burn victims largely, had been kept there for that time because of white phosphorus use. On the street you'd see people with amputations, people in wheelchairs. It's very difficult to negotiate a wheelchair in Gaza because of all the rubble, and people with canes, those kinds of things. So the human devastation was enormous, and using weapons that are not intended for a civilian population, indeed no weapon should be used on a civilian population. Then we get down to the material or the property damage, and that was even that was absolutely staggering. Mr. Corcoran talks about Jabalia and the devastation there. I witnessed that firsthand. As a matter of fact, there was an enormous rally for Hamas at Jabalia while I was there, and it indicates that the people certainly weren't turned away from support of Hamas. I think, frankly, the Israeli offensive from that perspective was enormously counterproductive. But basically, Gaza is at a standstill, an economic standstill. They don't have access to adequate food. They don't have any kind. The last little bit of economic infrastructure has been destroyed. There's joblessness is rampant. People, they don't have work, they don't have adequate food. When you drive south of Gaza toward Khan Yunis and Rafah, you encounter an enormous stench that results from untreated sewage going into the Mediterranean Sea because there's no electricity to operate the pumps that are used to treat the sewage. So it is an ecological disaster, it's an environmental disaster, it's a humanitarian disaster, and frankly, it is an outrage. What Israel did is an outrage. It's barbaric. Barbaric is almost too nice a word for it because it's used so commonly, but we haven't seen any attack like this on a civilian population, in my knowledge, with the support of a major power, ever. This is Israel's actions are unprecedented.
Tom, what observations of specific violations of international law did you make?
Well, we are still putting out our report, and we are being very careful in how we make our point because we think there's an excellent point. We are calling for an investigation, as many, many, many others are. We have found what a lawyer would call prima facie evidence, enough to indict, that Israel used weapons illegally, and it may have used illegal weapons. The weapons it used illegally certainly includes the white phosphorus. That is meant as a battlefield smoke screening agent. But that was used in a civilian area by Israel and caused enormous personal tragedy, burns. And also it burnt down, the white phosphorus burned down the United Nations main compound storage sheds in Gaza City. We visited that and met with John Ging while we were there. And he, you know, that man is a professional diplomat, but nonetheless he is outraged by what Israel did to the United Nations, as the Secretary General himself was when he visited Gaza. So the legal steps we're talking about, I think, number one, we have violations of international law. We certainly found a lot of probable cause for that. We're not a judge. We're not a jury. We can't convict. But we think an investigation ought to occur and somebody ought to be taking this up locally in the United States. I think it's fair to say that we found, based upon the facts that we observed on the ground, the interviews we conducted, and the devastation that we saw, there's certainly a clear indication of violation of the American Arms Export Control Act. And that ought to be enough to get America to the point where it has to deny providing weaponry to the Israelis.
Let's go ahead and take one more caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hello, you good people. Thank you. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay, thank you. What Tom just described, we don't have a clue of in this country because, as alluded to by an earlier caller, our media is pretty much controlled by AIPAC and NACPAC and CAMRA and the other Israeli lobby. What the Israelis have done to the people in Gaza, which is a virtual open-air lockdown prison there was no escape from, is worse than what the Nazis did to the Jews in the ghetto in Warsaw in 1943. It's incredible that our tax dollars are going to support this kind of activity. And a lot of it is due to ignorance and a control of a virtual control, which is way unbalanced of our legislature. The American people overall don't support the government of Israel, yet overwhelmingly, I think over 85% of our legislators receive funding from various lobby groups, and our media's all everything that comes out of Hollywood is controlled by a Jewish-led corporation. I'm not an anti-Semite, and that's a charge that is used frequently if you dare challenge or question any of Israel's policies. It keeps you quiet because we all have this horrific memory of what happened to the Jews in the death camps under Nazi Germany, and we all have vividly, people of my age anyway, pictures of American troops freeing the emaciated prisoners from some of these camps, and so there's a bond there, and there are good Jewish brothers that are trying to hang on to their little toehold in the Middle East, which God gave them, and all of these ridiculous myths about this militaristic, brutal regime that has been punishing these poor people, the Palestinians, for over 60 years now. I mean, my God, it was like a marauding elephant dumped on these people in 1948 when the Israel came to be by the United Nations, and they've been herding these people out of the way ever since. They overran 700,000 and moved them out of the way, murdered them, sent them into surrounding Arab countries where they still live in refugee camps. Those that remained within which are, they're not, Israel doesn't even have any borders. They've never defined any because they plan on expanding clear to the Euphrates River of it eventually. Anyway, I don't want to take up too much time, go on for an hour like this, but essentially these people were herded into two prison camps, and they've been punished ruthlessly ever since with our tax dollars. $3 billion per year we give them, and now we're giving them almost $1 billion to help rebuild, and that's not counting the international community that's come together to help Gaza rebuild. They can't bring back the dead little kids, but we're paying in times of financial crisis here money to destroy the hell out of everything, and help, we have to pay to help rebuild it. Mike, call your congressman, please. I urge everybody. 1-800-828-0498. That's 1-800-828-0498.
Thank you, caller.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
If AmericansNew.org is a wonderful website for all the historical information and everything you need, you'd want to know about Palestine, Israel. If AmericansNew.org.
Thank you, caller. Go ahead, Tom.
I just want to briefly respond to that anti-Semitism charge. Frankly, the leadership of many of the organizations that are appalled by the Israeli actions in Palestine are Jewish. Will Seaman here, that is absent today, is Jewish. We can't. It is not a Jewish issue. It's a Zionist issue, which is entirely different. And it isn't a racial thing. But somebody once called me an anti-Semite after I did a program like this at a university. And I said, listen, if you're defining Semitism as what Israel does to the Palestinians, then you put me at the top of your list of anti-Semites, because I could not oppose that more viscerally than I do. And if that is Semitism, I'm against it. So we can't let ourselves be bowed by this, somebody saying, hey, you're a racist because you don't like what Israel does, and Israel is a Jewish state. That if that makes me a racist, I'll be a racist. I've seen the effects of what Israel does on the ground all too often, and we got to get past letting somebody say, hey, you're an anti-Semite, as being a way to deter you from speaking truth to power. We have to speak truth to power.
Of course, the charge of anti-Semitism has been used again and again to shut down any criticism of Israel's brutal policies. It's time for me to make a few announcements, and then we can get back to Tom. The first announcement I want to make is a program that is put on by Brit Siddiq Vashalom. The event is The Politics of Water in the Middle East and the Developing World. It's on Sunday, March 1st at 4 p.m. The Portland chapter of Brit Siddiq Vashalom is having Speaker Congressman Earl Blumenauer. He's going to address water for the poor, confronting the challenges of a global water crisis. And Dr. Jeff Albert is going to address freshwater scarcity and its effect on the struggle of the Arab-Israeli peace. So this is going to be at 621 Northeast 76th. In Portland at Congregation Shir Tikva. The other big announcement is the upcoming Peace March just prior to the 6th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. It is this year for the first time going to take place in Salem at the state capitol at 1 p.m. Sunday, March 15th. So this is Oregon's next big Peace March, March 15th. In Salem at 1 p.m. at the state capitol. If you want more information, contact Peace and Justice Works at 503-236-3065. That's 503-236-3065. The last announcement of today's program is about Al Andalus Ensemble, a wonderful, wonderful band consisting of Tariq Banzi on oud, Charlie Bisharat on violin, and Julia Banzi on guitar. This program, Al Andalus Ensemble, 21 Strings, will be March 28th at 7:30 p.m. at the Kell Auditorium in Reed College. Again, that's March 28th at 7:30 p.m. at Kell Auditorium, Reed College. The number, if you need more information, is 1-800-838-3006. 1-800-838-3006. You can also go to www.andalus.com. Let's go ahead and take the last few minutes. Actually, I have one more announcement to make. Jeff Albert is the next guest for the show at 10 a.m. at KBOO, so please stay tuned to listen to Jeff Albert. Tom, why don't you wrap up our program for us by talking about what the next steps are going to be in terms of holding Israel accountable?
The next steps are going to be to identify what happened. And fortunately, there's an enormous database coming together involving Israel onslaught. Once we get that together and we take those steps, there are groups forming now. As a matter of fact, they're already formed that are talking about legal activities both under universal jurisdiction before the International Criminal Court and in various countries to hold Israel responsible. The fact that you may have a hard time figuring out who is actually doing the shooting in Gaza isn't a problem. It's the leaders we want to get. It's not the rank and file soldier, the private, the corporal, the sergeant. It's the leaders, and we know who the leaders are. And so all the shredding of this information, we know the people that put this together. We know who the Israeli commanders are who are responsible for the Air Force and for the Army's actions. It's the leaders you want. And that's the point of the Nuremberg trials. How many years ago was that the leadership that engages in war crimes is personally responsible, in some cases by death, in the case of Nuremberg. The policymakers who supported it are responsible. Now we just need a forum. One possible forum may be also the UN General Assembly, where activities are underway. I think the world is beginning to see the outrage that Israel has committed against humanity, not against the Palestinians, but against humanity, and is gearing up to take some action. And I'm delighted to be part of that group, and frankly, if any other listeners are out there with any particular skills that would be helpful, get a hold of me, and we can use your efforts in that endeavor.
Tom, how can our listeners get a hold of you?
Best way is by email. I'm going to give it twice. It's simple, Nelson, N-E-L-S-O-N, at thnelson.com. That's T as in Thomas, H as in Harry, Nelson, all one word, .com. Nelson at thnelson.com.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us this morning on One Land, Many Voices. Next month, Will Seaman, my co-host, will be back here with guests to talk about Israel-Palestine. And I want to also give credit to the Iraqi musician, Rahim Al-Hajj, who will be closing with Yearning from his album Iraqi Music in a Time of War. Thank you.